Time to start our meeting. All right, a call to order. May we have the roll call, please?
Commissioner Gilliland.
Here.
Councilmember Koval.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Mattusik.
Here.
Mayor Misarsik.
Here.
Councilman Empter.
Here.
Commissioner Curry.
Here.
Commissioner McGurk is excused. Commissioner Stowers.
Here.
Councilmember Ford.
Here.
Vice Mayor Long.
Here.
Councilmember Daniels. Councilmember Patterson. Councilmember Denny's is excused. Councilmember Cusack. Councilmember Northey.
Here.
Councilmember Wagner.
One of the two.
Just Josh and I.
No, Pat's here.
Commissioner Sasso.
He's getting coffee.
Mayor Sal.
Here.
Councilmember Saylor.
Here.
Councilmember Perone.
Here.
Councilmember Wheeler.
Here.
Mayor Gibson. Mayor Ardell.
Here.
Commissioner Shoup.
Here.
Linda Costello. Clay Irvin's excused. Gillis Blaze.
Here.
Bob Stork.
Here.
And Vicki White. We have a call.
Okay. Also, Pat Patterson is here. I think he's in the back, so. Okay, can we stand for Pledge of Allegiance?
Joyce is just walking in, too.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, well, welcome to all. And do we have, at this point, anyone for public comment? Don't have any notices. Okay, with no public comments, then we will go on to the consent agenda. Now, we do have one change to the minutes, and I don't think, Lois, they don't have copies of this, do they? So I just need to read it? Okay. So I would like you to just listen to this. This is a request to change. Council Member Wagner clarified that money for roads does not come from property taxes. The other possible funding could come from funding that is dedicated from the state or a referendum on a sales tax. He noted that he did not see SunRail going from Deltona to Daytona Beach without a funding mechanism in place. Okay, and I would need to have a motion to add
to approve
this
with that amendment.
With that amendment, second. All right, any further discussion? Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay, so that amendment is approved. Is there any other concerns, or do I have a motion to accept the consent agenda?
Move the consent agenda.
Second.
Okay. All those, any discussion? All right, all those in favor?
Aye.
All right, anyone opposed? Okay, very good. So the consent agenda has been approved. And now we'll go on to the action items. All right, the first one is review and approval of revisions to the Volusia TPO transportation priority process application and scoring criteria. So we'll turn it over to Bob.
Good morning. The review of the priority process applications and scoring criteria is something we do each year in preparation for our annual call for projects. This year was no different in that respect. We did actually, though, make a presentation to you all last month in order to get some idea of what concerns you may have, if any, in particular. We took that information back to the TIP subcommittee and the Bicycle Pedestrian Projects Review Committee, and we discussed the projects' applications and scoring criteria in depth. In particular, several issues relating to match requirements, funding limits, just the mechanics of going through the application process. And their recommendations were forwarded to the TCC and CAC for review and the BikePed committee as well. As a result of the reviews, the committees have recommended the changes that are included in your agenda packet. There really are only a few significant changes, and I will briefly explain those to you. First of all, the applications were amended to include, as part of the package, the Department of Transportation's project information form, which had been required of the applicants, but not as an actual part of the application process. As a result of that, we were requiring some redundancies, and we've now eliminated most of those in part by revising our own application so that we're not asking for the same information that DOT was. Another change involved the XU-funded bike ped projects and traffic operations ITS safety projects. We have a two-phase application process where for those project types, an applicant would first request a funding for a feasibility study. And we had a very abbreviated application form which would did not allow the review committees an opportunity to really evaluate the projects effectively. So we've added for those two types of projects a requirement that they provide a brief narrative addressing the key factors that we use to evaluate projects, those being mobility and accessibility, safety, support of comprehensive plan objectives, and economic vitality. Another change relating specifically to the bike ped project applications, we're now recommending that they those projects have a funding cap of $1.5 million during any 1 year or $3 million for any project over multiple years. This is the same funding limit that now applies to the XU-funded traffic ops ITS safety projects. So we have that consistency there now. Both the traffic ops ITS safety projects and the bike ped projects have a provision, the applications have a provision that allows the TPO board to waive the funding caps for special projects. And the final change was, sorry, I've forgotten. They did have a discussion about the local match requirements, quite a lengthy discussion about that. And in the end, they decided not to recommend any changes there. So the match requirements stand at 10% for the XU-funded projects and 20% for the Transportation Alternatives Program-funded projects. There is, there's one other change. This relates to the XU-funded traffic operations ITS safety projects. We did include a provision for bonus points when an applicant provides more than the minimum required match. This is the same provision that now applies for the bike ped funded or the XU funded bike ped projects. With that, I'll ask, are there any questions?
Okay, do we have any questions?
Motion to approve.
Can we get a second?
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, any further discussion? All right, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? Okay. All right, that passes. Okay, next we have review and approval of the resolution 2013-26 amending the 2013-2014-2018 transportation improvement program. So we have
there are
Robert back.
Four projects affected here. Two of them relate directly to the funding of the alternatives analysis, specifically the local match portion of the funding for that. With the county's consent, we're moving $513,000 from the LPGA widening project. That's the segment between Jimmy Ann Drive and Old Kings Road to the alternatives analysis project. And the local funds that are being pulled from the LPGA project are to be replaced with Transportation Regional Incentive Program funds. These are state funds. The other two amendments were requested by DOT. They are requests to remove the PD&E for US 17, State Road 15, north of State Road 40, for the reason that a traffic study that DOT had done showed that the traffic levels did not warrant a capacity increase at this time. The other project that DOT is requesting we remove is the PD&E for State Road 472. The reason for that is that they tell us that the PD&E for the I-4 managed lanes will address the issues at that location as well. Are there any questions?
Madam Chair, if I could clarify, though, the TCC, and we don't have the chairman here, and his alternate was unavailable as well, the TCC voted on those two items, the removal of the two PD&Es, to recommend deferring until January, and the reason for that was they had not seen the reports from DOT, and they felt like we needed a more formal request and justification to be presented outside of DOT liaison sending us an email. And so they have asked that be deferred.
I think that that's probably appropriate when your advisory committees are looking for more information, and I would certainly recommend that we follow that request, that we adopt that request.
And just to follow up on that, I've had a conversation with Frank O'Day, and I've transmitted some information to our liaison, Claudia, who's not here today, to go ahead and address that in a broader sense and make sure that we sort of have a formal process that we follow when DOT is requesting that we make a change to the TIP, to make sure that it's not just coming from the liaison, who really doesn't have a lot of authority or power to make other changes. And an example on the 1792 or 17 PD&E is they did recognize that there are probably some safety issues and some operational issues that still need to be addressed. But that it didn't warrant a full PD&E, that could be done in a much less expensive and detailed study. But we don't have that backup documentation anywhere. So
and
again,
if we pass
sure
this today,
we
won't have that opportunity to have that discussion with FDOT then. So I think there are four items on here.
Yes.
So we can move two of them.
Right, which are the two associated with the alternatives.
Right, okay. So I would move the two items associated with the alternative analysis.
Second.
Okay. All right, any further discussion or questions? Yes, Ron?
Would you adjust the microphone?
Yes.
We can't hear Ron.
Okay, Ron, you have your card up here next.
Could I hear the motion over?
The motion is to move the two items from this agenda that discuss the alternative analysis, and then I'll make a further motion to continue the next. Well, unless I can make it all as one, can I do that? And to continue.
Initial motion.
Okay.
So,
thank you, Rob. You want to make it for me?
You already made it.
Okay. I will amend my first motion to include continuing the other two items until January.
Okay, so Pat has seconded.
That way it's all done.
Okay, discussion. Ron?
I'm in total agreement with the motion to do that because I do believe the cities have not had the adequate information back to them as to what's going on there. Thank you.
Okay, any other comments? Josh?
I'd just like to thank FDOT and Lois particularly for managing this and putting it together in a way that we can fund it. I think the state has been a great partner over the last year and a half of really being creative and getting stuff done. I just want to make sure we realize that we appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. All right, any other comments? And I don't want to open a can of worms, but I just wanted to check with Bob. The alternate analysis study it's very expensive, and I just wanted to ask you, I know feasibility studies would probably cost about one-tenth of that. What's your view? Do you think we need to rush ahead with this, or would it be possible maybe to go with a cheaper feasibility study, a broad brush study to, you know, determine the needs? What do you think? Just want your opinion.
I'm going to defer because I don't know the fine details between the feasibility study and the alternatives analysis and the what's required down the line.
Certainly, Madam Chair. This has been a topic of discussion for a period of time here at the TPO, A, about how we're going to fund it, and B, whether or not this is the right type of study to move forward with. And we held a workshop before the last meeting in order to take the time to ask those questions, to try and get additional information, and to try and determine what direction that we want to head. In this particular instance, I think the county has been pretty clear that they're willing to move these funds to move this project forward. Whether or not that is settled in each of your minds still remains. There is, again, and this was presented at the workshop, an option to do that, to do a feasibility study instead, get more information, and then decide whether the timing is right for the alternatives analysis. But I think really that's a question that each of you have to answer for yourselves on whether you're ready to take the bigger, bolder step or a more reserved step.
Okay, Josh?
Just that the feasibility study doesn't get us to where we need to go. It puts us behind all these timetables that we're so worried about. You know, if we're going to really be serious about it, to be part of the conversation, you have to do the alternatives analysis. Feasibility study is more of an internal document that we would use to do the alternatives analysis. The funding's there. We've had the conversation of doing it. The question is it this year or next year? Mm-hmm. FDOT was, generous enough to work it out with us to do it this year. The argument of doing it, or I guess the discussion has already happened, it's just what year do we do it? This was just to bump it up a year to get us part of a better schedule to be part of that conversation in the summer.
Gene?
Two questions. What, in fact, would be the difference in bottom line information between the feasibility and the alternative? That's one. And number two, what would be the timelines if it was determined that we wanted to do a feasibility first?
Or Lois, someone?
The information would be similar. We would get cost information. We would get some ridership information. It would come up with a recommendation or a solution to deal with the traffic concern or the transportation concern. The difference is obviously the level of validity for that information. The feasibility study, as Councilman Wagner pointed out, is going to help us in some local decision, whereas an alternatives analysis becomes that next step towards funding. It would position the TPO for moving forward with funding.
Well, it seems to me that the question of the alternative study, in addition to the funding, which has always been an interesting, was the outcome. In other words, what it would show in terms of whether rail would be a feasible method, bus or none. Would a feasibility study give us that kind of information and or direction?
I don't think that a feasibility is contemplated, again, as being as detailed. So, it will give us some direction. It will give us some information, but, again, much, much less detailed than an alternatives analysis. So if there is a legitimate interest in moving forward with a project once the study is done, then doing the more in-depth alternatives analysis is the direction to head. If we're still trying to kind of do more preliminary planning and work something into a long-range plan and then continue to think about it, then a feasibility study might be more appropriate.
What about the timeline?
Completion of a feasibility study would probably happen in a year. Alternatives analysis, too.
Okay, Pat?
Yeah, I think that certainly the alternative analysis is where we want to go. We're not, we have to do that before we can talk about anything else. And a feasibility study just delays that discussion. This organization has consistently advocated that we have this conversation. We've had the conversation about whether we want to take a look at moving the project, and so to move the project, we've got to find out whether it's got whether it's viable, and the only way we do that is through the alternative analysis. So I think it's time for us to move it. The county has agreed to move money around to make this happen. The state, FDOT, is interested in seeing this happen, so the timing is right now, not a year from now, but right now.
Bob?
Yeah. The whole concern is basically whether this community has the financial wherewithal to do this. I mean, I hate spending a lot of money to come to the conclusion we don't have the money, because that's going to be the key thing on this. I mean, the key problem is I'm getting...
Bob,
into the
mic, please.
The key problem is we've got two questions: the feasibility and where's the money coming from. And we really need to determine, if we're going to go to a full-blown alternatives analysis, that we're really committed to spending that money. And I would like, you know, my concern is we're getting the cart before the horse, and very often this is how government gets itself in trouble, as well as private businesses. You get wrapped up in the dream, and you forget, and it's particularly appropriate comment just before Christmas, you get wrapped up in the dream, and then the reality is you got to pay for it. And I always say, before you go out to buy a big screen TV for Christmas, you ought to have your payment plan prepared. And that's my, before we spend a lot of money on this, I want all of us to be clear, and myself in particular, where's the money coming? Because this is going to be, I dealt with this in a community I lived in before, and they built it, and they didn't come, but the payments came, and they were disastrous. So I don't want to put the county into a horrible financial situation. We've got enough problems right now. So I would like us to put the cart before the horse. If we're going to do an alternatives analysis, we ought to have a very good sense, and this body, as well as all the other elected bodies, of just where the funding's coming from, and what we're willing to spend on it, because that's going to be the key thing. Trains are nice. A lot of things are nice, but can we afford it? And that's the question I have, and I would like to see. We're going to have some interesting sales tax debates coming up and the like, and the question is, this is going to be, I would assume, that will be the only source of funding for this, unless we can get state or federal, but I don't think so.
Okay, Lee?
Go ahead.
Right now, I guess most everybody knows that there's still some discussion on whether or not phase two of the rail is going to actually come through, or when or if that may happen. My concern is the federal funding that was promised, that was going to come through, is really up in the air at this point. If the phase two on the north end from DeBary to DeLand doesn't come to be, where is this going to leave this whole alternatives analysis and trying to get from the west side to the east side?
You know, it is, and we've dealt with this on other issues. We have current funding issues, and they can't stand in the way of some of our longer range planning and project development efforts. Obviously, if Phase 2 North didn't happen, then whatever came out of an alternatives analysis would have nothing to necessarily connect to. And so that extension wouldn't make sense. But because there are issues associated with sequestration right now, doesn't mean that those issues are going to continue. There is still a solid plan for making the SunRail project phase one and two successful, and I think there will be a continued push to implement those phases.
Okay, Josh?
Yeah, and I agree with Lois' comments just about that part as far as the phase two. My concerns is it's not necessarily with the dream. We all have dreams of what we can be. Mine is more focused on a nightmare, one in which I've brought up multiple times every time this discussion has taken place. There is a train, and it's going from Miami to Orlando. You know, and you are going to have a turn at Cocoa. The last thing we need to happen is for Cocoa to be Orlando's beach. Part of the alternatives analysis, part of this discussion that we have to really, as elected officials, really take pride in our community is we are an amazing tourist destination. We need to continue to be an amazing tourist destination. If we allow that train simply to go from Orlando to Cocoa and a station to be built there by private dollars, because it's a private company that had a dream, but they're going to turn a profit and they have some great development going on, we need to do this to be part of that discussion. We may not get it. It may not be the end result of the alternatives analysis, but a subjective report like a feasibility study is nothing compared to an objective report like a, you know, when you look at the two, really what it comes down to, you need that objectiveness to really have some teeth to talk to the state and the feds. I think funding, you know, if we were to sit around and say, okay, we don't have the funding, let's not plan and let's not have the discussion, then we'll never get anything accomplished in any of our cities or in the county. This doesn't lock us in any way for future funding. I think the county, I appreciated the county council that we took the step to go this route, and the state has really worked with us to try to get it done. And I think if we don't do it, we're really shooting ourselves in the foot because of that nightmare that could happen. If we're going to stay ahead of the game and really keep ourselves as a destination, we have to consider tourism rail as part of the conversation with commuter rail. It's not just commuter rail. It's about keeping ourselves on the map for having that. You know, there are millions of people who go to Disney every year. The old days of coming to Daytona Beach in Volusia County and people spending most of their trip here and then going to Disney for a day and coming back has changed. They're going to Disney and we're capturing a couple days. So that just, it's one small part of the conversation. But to continue that, we really have to move this forward. It's very, very important.
Okay, Gene.
I think you make a valid point. There's no question about that. My question, excuse me, my question again has to do with the difference between an assessment and another kind of study. And I think Bob had some valid points here too. Question in terms of both the feasibility and the alternative analysis. To what extent, because I've never been through one of those, so I don't have any idea of what the outcome is. To what extent would either of those delve into the question that Bob raised, not about the study itself or the results of the study, but the source of funding beyond that? If they recommend, for example, rail, what extension of financial resources would be provided in the alternative analysis and or feasibility study?
Generally, they'll provide the costs associated with it, whatever the recommended solution or the locally preferred alternative is, but they're not going to suggest how a local government might pay for that. And we do recognize that there is generally a local match that will end up being required, and for a project like this, it could be pretty substantial. And I think that's a part of, again, what the conversation centered around all along. Do we need to do a study that puts us in position for funding if that bar is so high that it seems tough to reach? That being said, I think as the county council member pointed out, they've shown the commitment to being interested in pursuing that by putting their local funds up.
Is there a stipulated local funding match involved? And if so, what?
Well, and again, there are always different options. If you look at the SunRail model, it's 50% Fed, 25 state, 25 local, that's made up of funding partners. Now, this is just one single county, so there wouldn't be other funding partners necessarily, or at least the funding partners would be local and within the area.
Okay, Bob?
Whichever, Bob, Rob.
Rob, Bob.
You know, there's a lot of dominoes that fall before SunRail actually gets to East Volusia, and this is one of the kind of earlier ones. You know, everybody knows Daytona's got over $1 billion worth of projects in the pipe right now, and it's because we went through during the economic downturn and did the planning, did the studies, made changes to land use, land development code, you know, worked with our private sector partners to figure out how to position ourselves so that when people started lending again, we could get these kind of projects done. To me, this is similar in that we're trying to position Volusia County to be able to move forward. If we do the feasibility study, to me, it's sort of a subset of the alternatives analysis. So if we could bite off a little bit now, and it would cause a delay in the whole process to bite off more later. But, you know, none of us know what the federal government's going to look like in a couple of years. We're going to have a, you know, the 16 presidential election. There's going to be a change in the White House, you know, with President Obama terming out. We got midterm elections coming up next year. You know, anything could happen. And I don't think that us trying to predict that and use that in part of this decision-making would be prudent. I think that, you know, to me, you know, Councilman Wagner, you know, as we changed the minutes earlier, you know, pointed out that, you know, this operational portion of SunRail is a significant issue. But I'm not sure that really is a question that we're trying to answer today with this item. I think that's a question that we have to, you know, make sure is present, that we're discussing it. But it's something that comes later. I think it comes after we get a little more information about where this alternatives analysis is going to go. So I think moving forward with this is the right thing to do. As much as I'm a fan of being very deliberate when you're looking at major investments like this, you know, I think biting off too little right now would be a mistake with the feasibility study. I think the alternatives analysis is the right way to go.
Okay, Lee?
Lois, after the alternatives analysis study, if that's the direction it's going to go, is done, I remember something being talked about an environmental study or something had to be done within 2 years of the feasibility study being done. And I believe the conversation was if we weren't really willing to take it to the next level that we would be committed to once that alternatives analysis is done, then that should be a factor. What was that? And I'm trying to...
Well, again, there is, as a result of MAP 21 trying to sort of compress the time frame for project development, the rules have changed. And really, the phase for doing an alternatives analysis no longer exists. And so we keep using that term, but this is really a study. There was a subsequent phase, which was the environmental analysis, NEPA. And those two have been merged together. And so what we really are doing is that analysis, that first step of that NEPA phase. But yes, we would move right into a NEPA phase. And I'm not exactly sure on the two-year time frame. I'd have to go back and check on that in the detail. But, you know, studies like this generally do have a certain shelf life. If what we were looking at is a project not being, you know, funded and moving forward a couple of decades down the road, then yes, this level of detail would be perhaps a little premature. But again, I don't think that that's the intent and the idea here. The assumption would be that we'd be following up, that we would be looking for funding to move forward with the project.
And the NEPA separate study is another cost of how much? About. Are we talking the same millions?
I would have to go and check again. You know, we're a part of the reason that this particular study is at the level that it is because we're really looking at two potential alignments. You know, we didn't narrow it down to a singular alignment, so they really have to discount one of those. So there's a lot of doubling of effort. The environmental phase, however, obviously involves a lot of additional work and additional agencies to review. But again, I'd have to get back with you on the cost of for the remainder of the NEPA phase.
Okay, Gene?
Quick question, Lois. As executive director of this board, what is your recommendation?
I'm sorry, what?
Let me rephrase that. Lois, what's your recommendation?
Madam Chair, I think that's an appropriate position to put our executive director in because, you know, we've got a 19-member board here. And, you know, to ask her to weigh all of the opinions of 500,000 people who live in this county, I don't think that's a fair question to ask.
Well, Lois, we'll just give you your option. You may comment or not comment.
Which is almost worse. Yeah,
and I would subscribe to that, too.
Okay. I think earlier on, when this was still an open discussion, that I probably would have recommended the feasibility study. I think the county's shown their commitment, and I wouldn't want to be anything other than supportive of that. I think, in addition, we sent a signal to the department by putting this on our priority list. I'm not a fan of sending a signal to the department and then they come to fund a project and then saying, no, not really. So I think, as has been pointed out earlier in the discussion, that decision really was made. That decision was made a couple of years ago. It was made, or at least opened up again during the workshop. And I think at this point we should move forward with the project.
Okay, any other questions, discussion? Yes, Barbara.
Thank you. I know that all of this discussion is basically circulated around Volusia, and of course, in the near future, hopefully Flagler's going to be a partner in this as well. And speaking for my community, I believe, is that the hope that the extension of this project will occur. And in the future, maybe Flagler County will have a way to access that travel route as well. And I know that the city of Bunnell is actively campaigning to get a railroad depot on the FEC coming down. And maybe in the future there could be some connectivity. So for whatever it's worth, your neighbors to the north, I think, would hope that this were to move forward.
All right, with no further discussion, and we have Pat's proposal. Okay, all those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed? Okay. All right, moving on to C, action item, review and approval of 2014 legislative priorities.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The packet that's in your agenda is formatted very similar to last year's legislative issues, and some of the items continue, or most of the items really continue. We start off with funding as one of our biggest issues. We all have recognized through a number of presentations and discussions that really at the federal and state level, we've got some structural issues to deal with. And so we continue recommending the implementation of some measures that were recommended from the MPOAC study. As well as asking that trust fund dollars don't be diverted to other sources. And we've certainly seen that when that doesn't happen, we're able to accomplish a lot. Going down the list for regional multi-use trails, and this is kind of the biggest change, there is a strong effort around the state to support legislation that would allow trust fund dollars to be flexed and used to go ahead and construct regional multi-use trails. That is currently not permitted from the trust fund, and so again, our recommended position is to go ahead and support legislation to allow that flexibility. Again, it doesn't create a specific set aside, but it does allow the flexibility when the interest is there and the support is there. And then the last two items pertain to safety and safety, continuing to support any activity that promotes and improves safety, and this is very consistent with efforts and statewide initiatives to improve safety in our state. And there will be a lot of initiatives moving forward, some of which are starting to be released and some of which have not yet been released, and some of that you'll hear about just a little later in the program. And finally, multimodal options, that is just to recognize that we have an evolving set of transportation options and ways that we're shaping our communities. There are new trends and technologies that are starting to evolve, and we want to make sure that we don't prohibit any of those or communities from planning for those in the future.
Okay, so do we have a motion to approve?
Motion to approve the 2014 legislative priority.
Second.
Okay, Pat Northey, second. All right, comment, Pat?
Well, I think it's great to have these priorities, but I think it's important for us to get with members of the legislative delegation to
to make sure they're aware of this and to keep it out there. We can send this up there, and then it gets lost in the shuffle. Having spent 10 years up there, I know how it kind of works by now. And so I would suggest that maybe the group that put this together, you know, make a plans on meeting locally with our legislative delegation before they go, because we can get more time with them than the 15 minutes you can usually get when they're in Tallahassee. So I hope that we can do something like that. And Lois, I'll work with you on that. Awesome.
Okay. Pat?
Yeah, that was going to be my question. What have we done in the past to make sure that our program, I mean, the hearings are already over. Legislative hearings are over. We did not make a presentation at the hearings, I don't believe, because we hadn't adopted this. So I think for next year, we need to do our process a little bit earlier so that we have the opportunity to be before them during the public hearing session. But having said that, what are we doing locally what have we done in the past locally to advance our interest?
Generally communicating these, sending them out, and then meeting with local legislators, whether that's during Volusia Days up in Tallahassee. But
I think we need to do it before then, is what Councilmember Patterson's saying. So perhaps if we could schedule after this holiday, I don't know, December, whether that's a good month or not, but certainly by the first part of January, if we could schedule meetings with our local delegation, and I'm happy to go and help sell the program.
We'll work with your assistants to go ahead and get those meetings scheduled.
It'll be important to do it in January, because in February they're going to be up
there
about
be up
3 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we need to get started on that right away.
Okay. Barbara?
Yes, one of your items talks about the legislation to promote continued development and expansion of bus and rail transit and alternate mobility vehicles. Is there, Lois, I didn't think to ask this, but is there any funding available today for communities to install charging stations? And this is a selfish request. I drive an electric vehicle, and I have to go very slow to get here.
You bring up a really good point, and there are some efforts in other areas of the state that I think have great merit in trying to find flexible funds, not only for things like charging stations, and there are some grant programs that are available for those sorts of activities, but also for conversion of fleets and finding ways to incentivize large fleets like waste management to be able to convert over to natural gas, because we just don't have the infrastructure that gives them a level of comfort to be able to do that. You know, it's a real chicken and egg situation, because the providers don't want to put the infrastructure because the demand isn't there. And in our neighbors to the north, the TPO that covers the Jacksonville area, they've worked with a program where they're flexing and putting forward some CMAC funds. Those are air quality congestion mitigation funds. We don't get those here because we don't have the air quality issues. But I absolutely plan on looking into opportunities for us to promote programs.
I just wondered, in the statement that's in there where it talks about the low-speed electric vehicles, that somewhere in there we might could have language that might expand the ability for funding for local governments for grants to do that type of thing. I don't know if that's an appropriate place or if this is the appropriate time and location, but
or maybe it could be included when we have our contingency that we'll meet with our representatives. So would that mention it then, I guess. If
and sometimes it's
possible.
Just the initial cost, because the people plugging in will pay. You know, just the cost of putting the equipment there.
Okay, Josh?
Just the fact that I really like the idea that Pat Patterson brought up. Obviously, I think Pat's a good person having in there. Pat on the executive committee, but I think Joyce as well. Anyone that knows the talk that's been up there, I think, is beneficial to have, because they know what they're going through. I think that goes a long way. So anyone else that has that type of history and that type of experience would be good to have.
Okay, Pat?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, that's
Joyce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's what we're discussing here is an excellent thing that we ought to be doing, and I'm glad that our colleague Pat Patterson brought this up. What we're doing here, we're lending our support and inclusion on these projects. The two that deal with moving money are the ones that we really need to horn in on with the legislature. The regional multipurpose use for the trails, I think that's one that you're talking money. And so that's one that we need to have the great discussion about with the with the delegation and with those folks that deal with the transportation issues, those committee members. And also the multimodal transportation options, that's money. And so those are the ones that we really need to concentrate on and be supportive of the other issues, but be very, very specific when you're talking about moving of funds and your support of that. And that's where you want, I believe, as a former legislator, is where you want to hang your hat. I just want to make that observation, Madam Chair.
Okay, Pat?
Did you want to speak?
Yeah, and I'm going to echo what Councilmember Cusack has said. A lot of it is done at the committee level. So, I mean, we need to talk to our legislative delegation, but we need to get in front of both the Senate and House side. I'd sat on the Transportation and Economic Development Appropriations Committee for 8 years. So, I mean, there are lots done with that committee, both in the House and in the Senate. So it's going to take some visitations to Tallahassee during probably in February, if we can work something out to meet with the various committee members and get our point across, but go from that. And with that, I move the previous question.
I'll second it.
Okay. We'll go ahead and have our vote. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? All right, very good. Thank you. And now we'll move on to our presentations. The first one is presentation of the draft changes to the federal functional classification of roadways.
Madam Chair, we have a consultant that's here that's working for the Department of Transportation to coordinate this effort between the local MPOs and members of the MPOs, the DOT, and Federal Highway. And so we have Heather. I'd like you to introduce yourself and talk about that.
Hi. Thank you, Lois. Thank you, everyone. Can you all hear me okay? I'm Heather Roberts with Kimley Horn. As Lois mentioned, we're working for FDOT District 5, and we're assisting with the functional classification updates. So today I'd like to talk a little bit about the urban boundaries and the functional classification updates. These are things that take place after every census. So I'll tell you a little bit about our status, our progress, where we're going next, and I'll talk in a little more detail about both the urban boundaries and the fun class. So you all approved a draft smooth boundary back in January. Since then, those boundaries for your group and all other groups through District 5 in Florida have been under review by FDOT Central Office and FHWA. We came to the October 15th TCC meeting and kind of kicked off the next phase, which is the functional classification updates with them. We'll be working most closely with a technical group to accomplish these updates. Since then, we've been reviewing your existing fund class network and made some initial recommendations. We held a workshop with some members from the technical group on October 28th here at the TPO. We've been compiling the input and updating some of those proposed changes since that time. Where are we going next? Well, we're going to continue to update Functional Classification Network with additional input from the local governments. The plan is to be back in January with both the citizens group, the tech group, and the board. To receive approval on both the urban boundary and the functional classification at that time. After that, we'll send them up to Central Office and FHWA for approval. It's important to remember that during this process, we do go through an overall update after every census, but this is not set in stone until the next census. It is possible to amend and change both the urban boundary and the functional classification network in between the census periods. So let me cruise on into the urban area boundaries. So back in January, you all approved your draft smooth boundary. Since then, Central Office and FHWA have been reviewing those boundaries. And how do we start with that smooth boundary? Well, we started with the raw census data based on population. Out of those surveys, they calculate population density, and they use that as a starting point to establish where the urban area boundary should be. After having that raw data, they then look and start smoothing irregularities. They try to follow along nearby roads, natural geographic features like rivers, lakes, those sorts of things, and kind of smoothing out that rough shape that came from the raw data. Throughout that process, they also look at including some additional commercial or industrial areas that may not have been captured. Because we're starting with the raw census population data, it's some of those areas sometimes get missed through that population density. So they look back and see what areas need to be included from that. So you did all that, and you had your smooth boundary back in January. The key thing here is that it is subject to FHWA approval. One comment that we have received from them recently, and we're talking past 3 weeks probably, I'm not sure if we thank you very much. Thanks, Bob. If you can see here, FHWA is requesting that this area in red, this is Eastern Volusia County, I believe it's near Edgewater. This is I-95 here, and this is State Road 40. I know the labels are a little bit small and hard to see. But this red area here, they've asked that we remove that. That is the Farmington Gateway Addition. There's been a slight change in the way that they've looked at doing the urban boundaries this year. In the past, I know back in 2000, they looked at including areas of future growth. This year, they have not been as flexible on that, and they really wanted to confine that boundary to where there is existing urban development. So that was a recent request that they made. We've discussed that with the CAC, with the citizens group and the tech group, and there's been some discussion about that. But that will be what we would be coming back to you in January for your ultimate approval on. So, unfortunately, you know, FHWA didn't get that comment to us until recently. It probably came out of some additional review through their other areas. So that's why you're only seeing it now, because we're just seeing it now. So that's the end of my urban boundary discussion. I'll head into fun class, but if there are questions now, I'd be happy to take them before we switch gears.
Pat has a question.
Yeah, I have a question particular to the Farmington area. How often is this review done on the urban boundary?
We do a massive overall review every 10 years after the census. So it takes a while for them to compile the census data. This is the 2010 census data that we're working with right now. So it takes 2 to 3 years to compile that data and start this process.
Okay.
So we do that overall review every 10 years. However, recent guidance that we've received from FHWA is that it is possible to send an amendment and update the urban area as needed, as often as needed, in between those 10-year periods.
So you don't review comprehensive plans that have been approved by the state as part of this, because that area has been approved by the state?
Right, and
that
was
comprehensive
some discussion.
Plan.
That was some discussion that came up at the technical group, too, is that there is planned development to go in there. Unfortunately, and I'm paraphrasing here, we have been brought in more to help with the functional classification, so I didn't help too much with this urban boundary process. We're just kind of moving it forward. But the guidance recently has been not to look at future plan growth, but to look at what's existing. And since there is not a whole lot of existing development in that area, they've requested that that be removed from.
Okay, so tell me what the urban boundary means then for purposes of FHWA.
As I mentioned, it starts with that population density, mm-hmm. and it's a look at really what areas they view to be functioning as urban areas currently.
Does it tie into funding for roads or transportation corridors?
Yes. As I understand it, there are certain funds that can be used in urban, and Lois, feel free to interrupt me if you've got some more information.
It does have to do with funding for both roads and transit, access to federal road funding. It also has to do with some level of service standards. Now,
okay.
As Heather mentioned, the two used to be very linked together, the classification of the road and the boundary itself. They have, through guidance, unlinked that. So there is a little more opportunity to have a road established as a federal aid qualified road, regardless of the boundary itself. But I think, as Heather mentioned, in my conversation with the representative from Federal Highway, which is Carl McKiska, who we all know pretty well here, what he said was when there's activity, when they can see activity, and they were open to trying to understand whether there was anything moving forward now. But his point is, look, in 10 years, it is unlikely that this would still cross the threshold for urbanization if there's absolutely no activity, there's no roads out there, there's no development underway. So they're trying to really tighten that up a little bit and not be as expansive as they had been in the past. He was amenable, again, to any news that perhaps wasn't available to them at this point, but I don't think there is any, even though there have been approvals out there, I don't think there's any movement. And I think his point was, look, in 10 years, when we do this again, you can...
Who is he?
Carl McKiska. He's with the planning department at Federal Highway. He has been the representative for Federal Highway.
Well, just one comment then, because the corner that is up by Edgewater, I would probably agree with you that the majority of it, it's a 25-year plan, but there is one corner that's adjacent to Edgewater that will be their first development section. So,
and if there looks to be some activity that's going to occur and we don't want to go through an amendment, I certainly think that through John Cheney or Darren Lear, we can sit down and talk about it. We can have a conference call with Carl McKiska at Federal Highway, and we can talk through this and see if they're open for any changes, if there's an interest in modifying that further.
Okay, John?
Yes, I was just going to follow up with that. Whenever I hear you can make a change later on and you can come in and ask for a change, wouldn't it be better to modify it? And if you don't mind, Ms. Northey, we have a lot of plans, I know, the county and that with water, movement of water, things like that. There's probably going to have to be some road building done to be able to do some of the things that I know the county and the cities have been talking about on the west side. So are there any impacts? It's easy to say it can be amended later, but how long would that take? I mean, it might take a considerable amount of time.
But your point is well taken. If the evidence is there now, then it makes more sense to address it right now. But it's a matter of having that conversation and making that case, if indeed the activity here appears that it's going to occur between now and the next census, and we don't want to go through that.
Should we get our two staffs, county and maybe the city in Edgewater, on before we settle on this?
I think the individual jurisdictions ought to be taking a look at this. Have they looked at this? I know that the TCC has been involved, correct?
The TCC has been involved, and again, it really was kind of hot off the presses when we had the TCC meeting a week ago, and so it was really the first time that they were hearing about it,
okay.
And both John and Darren plan on having some follow-up.
But we're not voting on this until next.
January, we'll be looking to make a decision,
okay.
So there's certainly...
Okay, thank you.
Gene?
I would certainly endorse getting the staffs together to take a look at it. Pat raised an excellent point that first section, first square up there is in fact very well along for development, and the southern portion, I haven't heard much of that, but I have heard that the northern section is... They're just looking, they are finishing their preliminaries and are now looking for development. So that's quite a ways along. And I would like to see the staff get together, as John recommended.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you. With no more questions?
Sure. Thank you all for your input. And now I'll continue on into the functional classification process, which is where we're headed next with this. So we kind of discussed this. This is just kind of a heads up of what's coming, and we'll be back in January for approval on these, and then back up to central office and FHWA for final approval, although they've seen it and made their comments at this point. So the hope would be that they're, that just is smooth signatures from here on out. Okay, functional classification. What is this? What are we talking about when we say functional classification? Well, the lovely definition there up on the screen is that this is the process by which streets and highways are grouped into classes or systems according to the character of service they are intended to provide. So, you know, in your daily travels, in your ride to work, you probably drive on several of these facilities. Maybe a local road takes you from your house to the nearest collector. That collector roadway takes you and distributes you to an arterial like I-4, I-95, 5A, you know, some of those roads. And then that you probably go through a similar process on the back end of your travels as you go back down to more of the local facilities and arrive at your destination. So these are the three big three that we're talking about here: arterials, collectors, and local facilities. Arterials, as I mentioned, things like US-1, I-4. You've got a long route. Very few access points, speeds are high. You know, these are roads that you're taking on a long trip from city to city or things like that. So they have very high daily traffic volumes, a lot of lanes to convey these vehicles and people to their destinations. On the other side, you have local roads. These are short roads. You're only on them for a short period of time. There are several access points and driveways, low speeds, that sort of thing. It might be a two-lane road. It really just kind of dumps you back into the collector and arterial network. The collectors are kind of in the middle. They pick you up from that local road and distribute you onto the arterial. When you take those three and kind of split them out into each individual classification, this is what we've got. So, in previous years, the classifications were not consistent between rural and urban areas. This time, they've gone ahead and made those consistent in between. So, you know, when you hit that smooth urban boundary, you're the same classification on either side. The only thing that changes is whether it's urban or rural. So we've got principal arterials, interstates like I-4, expressways like the Turnpike, 528, other principal arterials like US-1. Then we've got minor arterials, which still function as arterials, but they're just not quite as significant as the principal arterials. The change that they added this year also was splitting out the urban collectors into major and minor. Previously, we had just one category of urban collector. Kind of made it confusing when you hit that urban boundary and you switched to a rural area because you went from urban collector to either rural major or rural minor. They've done away with that. Now we have urban major and minor collectors. Some of you may remember the funding cutoff in this classification. To be eligible for federal aids, you have to be classified as a rural minor collector or above, but in an urban area, you need to be classified as anything above a local facility. So on this list in front of me, the only things that are not eligible for federal aid are the rural minor collectors and then the local roads in both rural and urban areas. So even though they split out that urban collector into major and minor, they're both still eligible for funding. Why do we do this process? Well, it's required by FHWA. It can help establish the relative importance of a roadway in the overall hierarchy. You know, when something like I-4 breaks down, we're all in trouble. So clearly that's a major facility that serves a huge network of people. This can be used for planning, budgeting, programming. Can be used to evaluate federal, state, and local programs. They do run some statistics on this over at DOT to come up with mileage and vehicles and all of that stuff. It can be used in establishing improvement priorities. What local implications may this have for you? A lot of comprehensive plans may make reference to specific level of service standards for different types of facilities, arterials, collectors, or locals. It's not intended that through this process anyone would need to change their comprehensive plan. However, if anyone's interested in looking at the classifications of those roadways and changing the roadways, we would want you to check with your comprehensive plan and just make sure that if you upgrade a facility to an arterial instead of collector, that you can still maintain that level of service standard. We talked a little bit about federal aid eligibility and the cutoffs for those. The general LOS tables, the level service tables, are broken down by area type, and that's based on that urban boundary. So that's the urban transitioning or rural that has less to do with the specific fund class of our $2 collector local and more to do with the urban boundary. Same with interchange spacing. That is based on the area type that you're located in. So this update process, what are we doing? It's important to note that there's already a functional classification network here and everywhere. It's not like we're wiping the board and starting from scratch and changing everything. There's already a network in place. So we're starting with that. We're updating the rural and urban breakpoints to the new smooth boundary. That's why that's kind of the first part of this process, is getting that approved by everyone involved. After that, we're looking at separating those urban collectors into major and minors. We're adding the rural expressway classification. That was a new one that came out this year, too, to make the urban and rural consistent. Then we'll correct any errors. Those could be omissions, realignments that got missed before any of that information. So I'll go through a couple of examples, picture slides in a minute, and this process can be revised today or at any time. We're going through an update right now, and whatever we can include, we'd be more than happy to. If something gets missed through this process, it's not a problem. DOT District 5 has an application process in place, and we can go ahead and fill out the application if there's a reason for a change at any other time. So let me go through these examples. This one shows a change based on the urban boundary. So on the left, you have your current classifications, and maybe a little bit hard to see, but these thicker lines here, those denote that it was in a rural area. And as you can see now, this red hatched area, that's the proposed smooth boundary, the urban boundary. And now you can see that the alignments do not change in thickness. It's all urban through there. Update to include new classifications, you know, the rural expressways and the urban minor collectors that they came out with. The purple lines are your collectors. And this is an option to show maybe a couple facilities that might be minor collectors instead. And I think they're hard to see there. They're there. They're in yellow. And again, that's just an example of maybe some that we were looking at that could be minor collectors.
We have a question.
Can I ask a question? We went through a very extensive process on reapportionment that really talked about populations and where they were located. Lois, is that where they would have, is that the same boundary that we used for reapportionment? It certainly looked like it up in Flagler.
Yeah, there's actually a little bit of a challenge right now in Flagler for determining what those boundaries are. Again, the whole idea of smoothing is so that we have some consistency with a road, for example. And we all, as you mentioned, had a very detailed discussion about how US-1 is affected, and you know, we didn't want that to hopscotch in and out of a planning boundary, because that makes no sense. And there's some challenge going on right now between Palm Coast and the DOT, and that makes it sound like it's a controversy, and I don't mean to portray it that way. They're still trying to work through the boundaries in that area, and the city of Palm Coast recently submitted a letter saying that, you know, they really believe that there should be some changes that so far the department and Federal Highway have not necessarily supported. And so they're still working through that. We have been involved, but obviously, and we try to monitor it, but we're not able to spend monies outside of our planning area to assist them. We have, through the TPO, used our general planning consultant, Tyndall Oliver, and made them available to our local governments should they have questions about boundaries or functional classification.
There just needs to be some consistency here, that's all.
Okay. Yeah, if you want to wrap this up.
Sure, absolutely. And then things like corrections, you know, this is something that may have gotten missed the last time around, that the main alignment through here actually travels up this way. So that green, that's a minor arterial, so that would be something that we're looking at fixing this time, and portraying what's actually out there. So the end result will be a map that shows both the urban boundary and the functional classification. And as I mentioned, we'd be back in January to look for approval, so we can send it on up for central office and FHWA to approve from there.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Questions?
Any further questions?
Yep.
All right, Barbara?
The map you're showing, of course, is Volusia. Since you're coming in January, at what point do we show the other areas?
In January, if all goes well, we will be an expanded board, and we will have to approve the Flagler boundaries as well.
Okay.
And so how will that affect your...
We had a conference call, actually, with some of the flagler groups to discuss Chad and Jose from Palm Coast and a couple members from the county, too. So we are working with everybody in District 5 to work on this. If Flagler is incorporated at that time, then we'd handle it together. If Flagler is not incorporated, we'd look at coming through your board of commissioners for approval.
Okay. Well, Pat?
I'm sorry.
All right, very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone.
All right, next we have presentation of the Volusia County Road Program.
I'm not going to give that. We actually have John Cheney here from Volusia County who's going to go ahead and...
You got any slides for us on this, John? Is there actually a program?
Thank you all very much. My name is John Cheney. I'm the Volusia County Traffic Engineer. We do have a few slides, ever so few. Jerry's unavailable, otherwise he would be giving this presentation. I'm a history buff, so I really love to go and reminisce about what we've done in the past because this was the heyday of the Volusia County Road Program from 2005 to 2013. We had a very robust road program. We've added 88 new miles of roads, a lot of sidewalks, and everything else. And if you take anything away from this map, please look at on the red areas and the dots and everything, where most of that was constructed. It was constructed in the urban areas. And if you remember during this time frame, this is when we had a very strong comprehensive issues with growth management, and we had those nasty words of hard concurrency and proportionate fair share and, oh my gosh, mitigation. And as we're moving away from that and we're relaxing those standards, this is what our new road program is going to be. This was adopted by the county council. You see that we have sufficient funds for basically the next 2 years, 12-13, that was our previous year. And so in the outer years, it's very minuscule. And we'll probably go back to what we used to do in the 1990s and early 2000s, where we have to squirrel away money for several years to bank it up so that we have sufficient funds to do maybe one or two roads a year with the widening and everything like that. And so this is what we're doing for 2012, or what our current road program is. If you've been in the Orange City or Ormond Beach area, you know we're doing construction on Timber Creek and the widening of Saxon Boulevard. This fiscal year, these are the different programs that we're looking to do. Also take note that we do a lot of partnering. We've done a lot of partnering in the past with a lot of the local jurisdictions, with the development community. And as we move forward, again, you can see the different roads and bridges we are proposing to build. But at the end of the day, it takes money to match money. And we've done an excellent job of matching money. Ratio 1.7 to 1, basically. And we've invested a lot of money. And we won't have that capacity in the future just because of the revenue streams. And with that, are there any questions?
Okay. All right. Ali?
John, Bike Florida, the state bicycle group, we're going to have about 800, 900 cyclists in March in the Daytona Ormond area staying at Seabreeze High School. We'll be riding those areas. We have a trip around the Speedway and then through this area. So who could I contact to make sure, because some of these roads like the Pioneer Trail and some of those other places we're going to be on, who could I work with or know, because that's going to affect our routes that we've already started planning, unless these projects aren't going to start anytime soon except for the ones that are already done.
The best person would be Todd Buckles, who works for Jerry, who's our construction manager. We also place on our website the construction projects that are forthcoming and when we anticipate them starting.
Okay, anything? Josh, did you have a question, or anyone else have any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Twice.
Okay. Next presentation on the pedestrian crosswalk safety program. Stephen?
Dr. Ron Van Houten and Dr. Louis Malafant are Vice President and President of the Center for Education and Research in Safety. They both are internationally renowned researchers and have worked together in the area of pedestrian safety for the past 30 years. Dr. Van Houten is a member of the National TRB Pedestrian Committee and has put together the research program for the past 15 years. Both of them will be awarded the 2013 Waller Award by the National Academies Transportation Research Board for the best transportation safety research in the nation for 2013. This research study entitled High Visibility Enforcement of Pedestrian Right-of-Way Laws was carried out in Gainesville, and the work they did in this area and in Metro Orlando this past year is based on the results of their high visibility enforcement study. Their report is included in your agenda packet, and I'll present to you Dr. Ron Van Houten.
Okay, here's my associate, Louis Malafant, crossing. I don't know if you can see this, if he showed you this slide before, but the driver there who's not yielding right-of-way to him is telling him he's number one, using one of his fingers to indicate that. Over the years, we started out, we used to see a lot of really rude behavior in regard to motorists directed to pedestrians, and I think that's declined over the years. We're seeing much better behavior in the state of Florida, and there's been some changes. Hopefully, that's going to translate into some changes in crashes. Our objectives were to increase yielding by drivers to pedestrians, decrease darting out in front of vehicles, and pedestrians and signaling attention across, and teaching drivers to protect pedestrians at crosswalks, and pedestrians to make crosswalks work for them. And there's an awareness problem here. And we've got an increasing problem with distraction, both the drivers and pedestrians, I'm sure you're all aware of. And that's growing, and it's a major concern for the Department of Transportation. Enforcement countermeasures begin with warnings. And the reason we begin with warnings is because in most jurisdictions, they have them in many, they usually don't write citations for failure to yield to pedestrians. And we have actually done this all across the country, in New Mexico and New Jersey. In some places, they've disregarded our advice on this, and they start to go in with citations. And they get a black eye when they do that. The public don't respond well. We want the public to be a partner with us on this. We want drivers to be partners. And after all, drivers are pedestrians a lot of the time. So we start off with that education phase, the warnings. By the way, warnings do work, despite what you might think. You stop lots of, you do like to be stopped by a police officer and warned, you get detained, you don't like it. But if they give you a flyer and they tell you why they're doing it, and they're not giving you a citation, they're trying to make the community a safer place, and they're giving you that fair warning, it helps. So we start with that. And the flyer is really a critical part of that. And we use those signs downstream that you probably saw. They may have shown the large signs that there's a pedestrian enforcement operation, in effect. Why? Because we used to do enforcement operations and people would give us the seatbelt salutes that went by. I'm wearing my seatbelt. They didn't know what we were doing. You can't stop everybody. Not everybody has the opportunity to yield to the pedestrian. We want everybody who's going by to know what the police are doing, because that helps to get the effect. It helps multiply the effect. It's a force multiplier, in a sense. So we use that. Rapid rotation between many sites and use of standardized procedures that have held up in court. And worked hard on that. One of the things we developed and worked with some other people, John Moffitt out on the West Coast, is the idea of having a real careful definition of failure to yield. It's objective, an operational definition. So we work out the dilemma zone using the signal timing formula. If you're beyond that point, you could have yielded to the pedestrian. You do have a defense. Your Honor, I run all red lights. That's my defense. Because we're using that formula to say, hey, if you see a pedestrian in a crosswalk at that distance, you can yield. So we do that. We've got that, and it stood up in court, and we've had good results there. And that's important, because police officers don't like to do work, good work, and have them thrown out. So we've got to make sure we give them a program that will actually work for them. And we use some low-cost engineering. One of the things I worked on for years is advanced yield and stop markings. I started with stop markings. Yield markings came in later. In Florida, you can use either the stop or the yield marking. Why do I have these markings out a distance before the crosswalk, encouraging drivers with a sign to yield in advance of the crosswalk? I'm going to go through this real quick and only once. I live in the past, and so does the driver. That past is my reaction time.
This is a car that stops too close to the crosswalk. I can't see past the car. The driver in the next lane on the multi-lane road can't see me. I look, and I realize within my reaction time, I'm hit. If I were a safe pedestrian, I would stop here and look. We train the police officers to do that. We don't want them to get hit when they're doing an enforcement operation. However, we can also encourage the driver to yield further back. Those lines increase yielding a bit. That's one thing they do. They're not a miracle work, but they do increase yielding some. But they really increase yielding further advance in the crosswalk a lot. You see very few people yielding close. And that's what generates that multiple threat crash. And that multiple threat crash is serious because it's usually fatal or incapacitating because there's no time to brake, and you're being hit, and get all that energy from the vehicle is being transmitted to the pedestrian. I've seen videos of people who looked, children, were struck and killed because we capture those things now sometimes from the camera, unfortunately, because the driver yielded too close to the crosswalk. So, okay. That's why we encourage those. We've been doing that for years. It's in the manual now. It's in the Florida manual, so it can be done. Sometimes in street signs, the rectangular rapid flashing beacon I'm going to speak about in a moment, you have one of them in Daytona Beach Shores. They work reasonably well. That one's not using the high-intensity flashers that the original one that I evaluated for federal highways used. I was the lead researcher on that. But they do work, and they do increase yielding quite a bit. And with enforcement, as Mike Fredericks have found, you get even higher levels of yielding. In our study, we found that communities that were doing enforcement got 90% yielding at those overall, and those that didn't were getting between maybe 75 and 80% yielding. So enforcement is making a difference no matter what you do. It's part of the triple E approach. Educational applications, we have a lot of those. One of the things I just want to suggest to you or show you is that we have these large highway feedback signs, and, well, there's the advanced marking. And here's one of the signs we use in Gainesville. That's as we were early on, they got up into the 80s. We used these originally for speeding, drivers not speeding last week, and we reduced speeding with those signs. With enforcement, it works even better. We used it for as part of Click It or Ticket. We were part of the North Carolina program designing Click It or Ticket for seatbelt use. We used it there all through North Carolina, and it helped to push the numbers up for wearing seatbelts. And it works here for pedestrians as well, something you might want to consider in some of the areas in the future. It's a repeat. Here's the rapid flashing beacon. We did have one of these sites. We had the highest yielding here at that site. It was 75%. I was out there yesterday collecting some follow-up data because I neglected to do it at that particular site, and it was up to 100%. Now, that's when a pedestrian enters the crosswalk. You have to do that. By law, if you stand on the sidewalk, they don't have to yield to you. In some jurisdiction, they will yield to you if you're standing on the sidewalk. And we may see more of that here. But generally, drivers know they're supposed to yield when you enter the crosswalk. You push that button, and some of them will yield when you're on the sidewalk quite well. So that's working pretty well. And with the enforcement, and the police have done an awesome job with the enforcement. I'm really impressed with that. There's been real changes. Okay, in Daytona Beach Shores, yielding went from 50 to 80 at the site with the advanced stop line, and from 81% yielding over 30 feet at that particular site. At sites without advanced stop lines, yielding went from 26 to 60%, and only 68% yielded over 30 feet from the crosswalk. And here's a few graphs to back that up or support that. So you don't have the advanced stop lines yet at all the sites. I'm aware that they're going to be probably putting those in the future. In New Smyrna Beach, they do have them at each of the crosswalks. They put them in at multi-lane roads. And I really encourage that very strongly because I don't like to see multi-lane crashes, these multiple threat crashes. And in fact, in our research on the RFB, we always put advanced markings on because they were put on multi-lane roads. All the data show the effects and the safety effects with those lines marked with them, and yet some communities are putting them in without. So went through that, and there's some data on the stop line. In New Smyrna Beach, we had 47% initially, and after is averaging about 84%, and many, many are yielding. You really can't say, best on a limited sample, it's probably in the 90s that are yielding at the line or at the marking. Basically, this research, the things we're doing here are based on the research we originally did, which we presented to FDOT safety office, and based on that, they've opened up funding for other communities to try it out. And NHTSA, who funded the original study, wants us to do a follow-up now to see how things are going 3 years later. The other thing I have to say is that if you want to keep the numbers good, you have to maintain some level of enforcement over time. That is something that the police will probably have to do. But they have done an awesome job, and compared to other jurisdictions, they've gotten some fairly good results. Any questions?
Okay. Dr. Chair, asked you about the flags.
Yeah, Louis actually, when he did his dissertation many years ago, noticed that they were doing those flags in Japan. They were the first to do it, actually, Japanese. Since then, they started to get used in California and a lot of other jurisdictions. The flags work. Anything that signals your intention to cross, makes it more clear to the driver that you want to cross, does help. And we're seeing a lot more of that courteous behavior on the part of drivers, and it's clear. Some of them are waving back. I wave a lot when somebody yields, wave thanks, and often I'll get drivers waving back to you. And sometimes coming up, they'll flash the lights to indicate, hey, we're going to yield. But the flags work. I did do some evaluations, so I saw the flags out in Ponce Inlet, and the yielding is up out there too. I think the enforcement is the big part. We did not use the flags when we did the post-evaluation out there. We got higher yielding, but we didn't use the flags, and that's the work of the police. But there's no question, if we used the flags, it would be a little bit better. The downside of the flags is sometimes they all get accumulated on one side of the crosswalk if they're used a lot, and so you have no provision. Sometimes maybe a courteous person will take half of them and move them across to the other side, and sometimes they get stolen. Vandalism is always an issue.
Okay, Joe from Ponce Inlet.
Unless I'm mistaken, what I learned from reading some of the literature on the pedestrian safety program is that the same regulations evidently that apply to painted crosswalks at intersections also apply to crosswalks where there are no painted crosswalks.
That is correct.
And is anything being done to educate motorists, pedestrians in that connection?
We usually start with the marked crosswalks because it's a little bit easier to get the buy-in from the drivers. But you're right, they are supposed to yield there, and a lot of drivers don't understand that those are also crosswalks. Police could go and start doing enforcement at some of those locations later on. There was one in Florida. In many jurisdictions, if it's a stop control on the minor road and you have an intersection, they're supposed to yield right away on the main line, right away. But if it's a T intersection, there was some dispute about that. I don't know how that's been resolved in Florida. And a lot of locations say, yeah, those are crosswalks. They are, even if they're not marked. But there was some over the years. It's not clear in Florida how the courts have ruled on that. Should add that.
Okay, very good. Any further questions? And if not, yes, Stephen?
There were additional crosswalk enforcement operations here in the city of Daytona Beach with similar results.
Okay, very
good.
I'm
sorry about that. I didn't mention. The reason I didn't put up data slides for those is we did not have baseline data there. We collected baseline at a few sites in Daytona Beach, but the police captain said we really are more concerned about some of these around the universities and wanted us to go there. And we had not collected before data. So they were out there doing enforcement at those sites. And so since we don't have before data, I can't show you a data slide. But I think they did good work out there as well.
Very good. Yeah. Okay, thank you so much. All right, with no further questions. Okay, now we go to the DOT report. I guess Claudia is out, so we have Vicki today.
Hi, Vicki White, Jeff DOT. I'm from Claudia's report. There's no new construction updates at this time, but if anybody has any questions or concerns about any projects.
Okay. Any questions? No? Well, thank you. Oh, yes. Lee, you have a question.
Vicki, a couple months ago, I had brought up the 92 with the grooves that are in the highway, especially eastbound on 92 and the outside lane. I had somebody call me. They thought I was talking about the construction there at the bridge. But I haven't heard any more on what those ruts are or how or if they're going to fix them. Or
okay, I can check it out and get it back to you. Information to you.
Okay. All right, very good. Thank you.
Can I just make a quick...
Sure.
For the DOT work forum public hearing that's scheduled for December 11th, Wednesday at 6 o'clock at the DOT. We are going to be broadcasting this by webinar. If anybody's interested in having it, hosting it here, just let Claudia or myself know.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. Okay, Lois, director's report.
Thank you. The first item is really just a housekeeping item. There was some concern at a previous agenda, or board meeting, excuse me, that the agenda packet didn't include a more detailed report for folks to reference when a question came up. And there had been a policy change here a while back to reduce printing costs, to reduce the amount of resources that we put out there when we print lots and lots of thick reports. So the standard practice is when we have a detailed report is we make that available online. It's included as a part of your agenda packet as a reference, and you can go and look at that in advance. I would just let you know, if you want a printed copy, by all means, let us know. We do have some members who are very clear about they want a full printed agenda. But again, unless you make that clear to us, we will continue to refer to reports and make them available with a link on our website in advance for you to review. With regards to our corridor improvement program, we've done a series of studies. First, we tackled US 1. We tackled US 1792. In the case of US 1, there was some follow-up work. We were looking at moving on to the next project to utilize funding that we still have in that particular program, and a discussion occurred at the executive committee, and we've been directed to go ahead and tackle the St. John's River to Sea Loop as a trail corridor. Again, earlier in the program, I talked about the potential funding changes, and here in Volusia County, the St. John's River to Sea Loop, the easternmost leg is a part of the East Coast Greenway. The southernmost leg is also a part of the Coast to Coast Trail, and the westernmost is a part of the Heart of Florida. So in Volusia County, all of our major regional trail alignments are really a part of two major statewide efforts. So between local interest in developing our trail, statewide interest, and regional interest, we thought it prudent to go ahead and study that and make sure that we knew exactly what the alignments are, where those projects stood in terms of development, and make sure that we could try to shepherd those projects forward and take advantage of any funding changes. So we'll be starting that project here in the next few months. As far as reapportionment, I have very good news. We have received resolutions of support from the two remaining local governments that had not submitted them to us previously. So we've got all of the resolutions that we need for unanimous letter of support to send up to the
Woo-hoo!
Secretary. Thank you, Lee.
Good job.
I have been in contact with the folks up in Tallahassee. They are aware that package is coming, and we should be able to get that up to them next week. So that's very exciting. And then we'll await news. So with that in mind, we are looking at January for going through and executing those agreements. We still don't have all of the draft agreements returned to us from DOT, but we'll continue to work on that and get those out for local review. Those will be the agreements that each of you sign when we get together in January. And so that being said, we have a number of items that are required to be acted upon as a part of the board meeting in addition to reapportionment. We could do that in two separate meetings, but I know a number of you drive quite a distance to get here. So the thinking is that we have that as a single meeting, as a part of our board meeting, again, in two stages. I'm just giving you fair warning that will be a long meeting. You schedule that on your calendar. Your attendance is extremely important, however, to make sure that we can go ahead and do the work that we need to do, including amending our long-range plans and making sure that all of the different projects are moving forward and nothing gets caught up in this particular activity.
What's that date?
Can I comment on that?
1 second.
Before she makes
on January 22nd.
Right, Lee has a question.
It's not really a question. It's more of a comment. And being chair of the reapportionment committee, I'd just like to thank both the staffs and all the city staffs and Volusia and Flagler counties in working with this. I know it started out as a huge project, but with everybody working together have come, you know, some give and take, but I think we've really forged a really great relationship between Volusia and Flagler and come together as one. So thank you to everybody, staffs and cities and everybody working together to get this done. It got done a lot sooner than I thought it was going to, so congratulations to everybody.
Thank you. As Vicki mentioned, we're program public hearing on December 11th. Always a very exciting meeting when we get to hear what the department has been able to fund. That starts at 6 o'clock over in the DeLand office. We will be offering an opportunity for folks to come here and watch it via webcast. We would just ask that if you do and you want to do that, let us know in advance that we are not here for no reason. I always prefer to actually be there if we can. So again, if you'd like to participate from here, again, for those of you that are don't want to make that drive all the way over to DeLand, we'll make that opportunity available if there is a demand. We've scheduled the date for the annual board retreat tentatively on February 28th. So please, we did send out a save the date, and if you could put that on your calendars, I would appreciate it. And then as I wrap up, I just want to wish everybody a happy holiday, since we will not be meeting in December for Thanksgiving and any other holidays you observe between now and the end of the year. I hope you do that safely and enjoy holidays.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. And I want to add also, it was part of the consent items, but Lois was evaluated, and the executive board also comments. I thank everyone who helped with her evaluation. And she did meet or exceed expectations in all areas, so her contract will be continued. I just want to say thank you. I think she's done a great job stepping in. So, all right, anyone else with further comments as we end our meeting? Go around the table. Rob?
I think everybody's heard me mention a couple of times that as we move into the 1792 I-95 I-4 interchange reconstruction, the 60% plans had SunRail coming across at State Road 400 and terminating in the median in front of Andrews Isles. And I apologize for I just got an email kind of late yesterday about this, but my understanding is, Lois, you had a conversation with Frank O'Day over DOT, and they now have about six different crossing locations. Could you just give us all kind of an update on where that is?
Yeah, I've just had one conversation. There will certainly be some follow-up conversation. You know, as we move forward with an alternatives analysis, as we complete or wrap up, or DOT wraps up this station study, that their intermodal station study that they're working on, we're starting to try and narrow down what may happen in this area, and there has been a concern for a while about making sure that the system's interchange doesn't preclude us from pursuing a good alignment and a good project in the future. Obviously, that project got advanced 15 years in the work program, which was pretty stunning and a surprise for us. But in conversations that I've had with Frank, he's identified that, yeah, there are about six windows throughout the system's interchange where a rail alignment could potentially enter into this area. There, again, will be some follow-up discussion that needs to occur. Again, just confirming, for example, the overpass right here at 92, where I-95 goes over, that it is going to be high enough and wide enough should that be an entry point. Likewise, any overpasses that may need to occur and the design of on- and off-ramps. So again, we'll continue those discussions and ask more detailed questions as well.
So since they have six locations identified already, could we get something from them in writing that sort of identifies what those are? I see Mary back there shaking her head. Maybe. Look, that was, it's not a real confident shake.
If we have it, we can certainly send you.
Okay. And like I said, it was, I think everybody, you know, the original location was based on where the rail envelope was in I-4, and it wasn't ever intended to really be there, but now all of a sudden we thought that was going to sit on the shelf for quite a while, and it's moving forward very quickly. So I'm interested in seeing kind of where those crossings might occur. So thank you.
Okay.
go back to Pat.
Yeah, it also raises the question then for, I hadn't even thought about this, Rob, until you started talking about that, the ultimate build-out for Interstate 4 from 472 south, depending on where that rail alignment, if it was to come in, that's also going to be something that has to be taken into consideration on that project, Mary. I'm looking at you, so we can...
You're talking about the 472 interchange.
Yeah, I'm talking about 472.
That was a part of our conversation
okay.
as well.
All right.
Okay, as we go around the table, any other comments? Burning comments, Lee?
Lois and I, a couple weeks ago, attended a workshop, kind of interesting workshop over in Orlando, just to kind of give you, we've been talking more locally about how to fund transportation and projects, and just wanted to let everybody know and give you an update. There is something going on regionally to try to connect all the counties involved in SunRail to come up as a region to fund the SunRail projects, because say we can fund it locally here in Volusia and Seminole can't or doesn't, and then Orange does, the train's not going to jump over Seminole. I mean, so does everybody have to absorb what Seminole isn't going to pay? Not that that's going on. That's just an example. So they hired Dr. D. Alsop to come in, and he had worked on projects around the United States on how to look at people to understand what these type of projects will help them understand what they're going to do for them. And they look at the way people think, what they like, what they don't. So there's a big regional push to work together to try to help somehow fund all these transportation projects regionally. So we still are going to have to do some of our own. But if we're looking at a sales tax and the region is looking at a sales tax, those types of things, I think we need to keep involved in what's going on to the region so we aren't counterbalancing back and forth doing something against what the region's going to do. So just to kind of give everybody an update. Lois, any more on that?
Right. This is a part of the Heart and Minds Value Study that this TPO has been a funding partner for. And some of you may not remember because it was a while back that we actually supported that. And there were a few delays, but it is moving forward. It was a very, very interesting session. Included a lot of business leaders from around the Central Florida area.
Public and private.
Public and private and other institutional representatives. So, again, yeah, we should be seeing something in the spring bringing some information back on the research that they're doing.
And happy Thanksgiving.
All right.
I'm glad you made your comments about the about Lois's evaluation. The for those of you that were here, it was it was a difficult time for a lot of us. It was more difficult than others. And the changes that we made, this is a TPO, and I just have to tell you, I couldn't be happier with an executive director and the changes that have been made. I used to come to these meetings just I didn't like them. I didn't come. The meeting itself, I felt somewhat. Things were moved around. I don't want to live in the past, but it's a different day now when I come. It's very positive. I have to say that I don't think there's a better director out there that you could go after than Lois. I mean, she is really, over the last year and a half, it's amazing the change that we've had our relationship with FDOT. I mean, it has just blossomed into some great projects, great relationships, and I really do think, I think this board's great. I do think we have great members, but I think a lot of that has to do with Lois. I think she has been an exceptional leader. And a director that has just been unbelievable. I can't say enough good things, Lois, of what you've done. I just very, very, very impressed with your professionalism, your willingness to work, and just getting the job done in a way that I think is effective. And I think it's perfect. It's a blend of everything you could ask for in a director, so thank you.
I will say she certainly made my job easier this year. So, okay, anyone else as we go around the table? Any comments?
I'm sorry, I forgot one. It's Nick Koval's last meeting with us.
I'm sorry?
Is this your last meeting with
yep.
us? And he's been with us for quite a while, so I would just like to let Nick know how much we've appreciated him and his comments, and we're going to miss you on the board. So thank you, Nick.
Yes, thank you,
You're
Nick.
You're quite welcome. It was my pleasure, and I just have to say it's
been a great ride, and I enjoyed being part of this process. And DeBarry will prosper even further, hopefully in the future. I will not sit by idly. I'll be around, and you'll see me around. Thanks very much, and I appreciate being with you.
Madam Chair, you have a certificate of appreciation.
Oh, I do?
At your place.
She's sorry, I didn't have that in my notes, yes. Okay, yes, Nick, you want to come
over? Oh, good.
All right, come on up or I'll take it to you. All right, let's give him another hand. Thank you so much.
If I could just briefly mention, I hope that you do stay involved, because it's not every board member that tells me on the side, I don't give a rat's. I have something to say. I appreciate that candid input.
Okay, and with no further I just want to wish everyone a happy holiday, and I guess I broke my promise to try to keep the meetings to about an hour and a half today, but we had good discussion. And I do ask that you, when you get your packet for January, it's going to be a long meeting. Please do your homework. If you have questions in advance, call Lois. But come prepared so that we can really go through these issues and get them resolved. So have a wonderful holiday, and we'll see you all in January. Take care.